April the 12th. We are opening a public hearing and possible work session on Senate Bill 5501, the Department of Administrative Services. We left off yesterday with Mr. Radford and the State Controller's Division, and we welcome you back this morning. And we'll take up where you left off.
Pick it up.
Thank you. I apologize. Senator Morris.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for allowing my guests to join us in the dais. Kate is from Russia. Foreign exchange students, and they're staying in Corvallis. And Farid is from Azerbaijan, and they are with us for an hour this morning and learning about our government. And so we welcome you and hope you have a great day in the capital. Thank you.
Good morning. Thank you very much for being with us this morning. If you have any questions or there's anything that we can help make clearer to you as we move through this morning, if you just give the signal to Senator Morris, we'll stop and try to get you caught up on where we are. Good.
Okay.
All right. Good morning.
Good morning. I'm John Radford, State Controller with the Department of Administrative Services State Controller's Division. And I'm going to pick up pretty much where we left off yesterday. I'm under the tab marked State Controller's Division in the yellow book. And I'm going to start on page 28. Page 28. This page is titled Fees and Assessments, so I'll go over this morning and try to go as fast as I can because I know these guys behind me want to get up here and have some fun. So, fees and assessments. The fees and assessments to your right there on that one chart that breaks out assessments at 15.7 and 10.5. Let me go over what those are. The assessments, we use an allocation methodology to allocate our fixed costs, mostly from our statewide accounting and reporting unit, our SFMS fixed costs, our statewide financial management systems. These are the statewide accounting system fixed costs, some accounts receivable, and e-commerce support. Those are like policy and administrative types of costs, and so those are allocated out to state agencies primarily on the basis of accounting record counts in the system. This is a kind of a relationship. And FTE count some portion of that is allocated on the basis of debt. It's related to the production of our annual financial statements. So we've tried to ascertain some kind of relationship between how the fixed costs of our systems are allocated and burdened onto the agencies. The fees are primarily fee-for-service charges, so there's a relationship between supply and demand. You use more, you pay more. You use less, you pay less. And so good examples of that are our accounting costs, payroll costs for payroll, and accounting costs for producing checks, so payments. So if you use more checks, you'll pay more. There's a per-check charge. There's a per-check charge on the payroll side. So if you issue more payments through the payroll system, you'll pay more. If you issue more payments, less payments, then you pay less. Does that make sense? So kind of two different ways of allocating costs. One's on an overhead allocation basis. The other is on a per-item charge because there's a relationship between supply and demand. Okay.
I guess my only question about that, and the reason I look a little perplexed, is I keep thinking back to the state agency head of a little agency who's trying to manage and control costs. What I think I hear you saying is that there's an opportunity to manage some of their costs by the amount of activity that gets run through your shop. How complicated would that be across DAS's range of services that you offer? I'm trying to figure out, in some cases, the assessment comes out as a just X number of dollars per head. And I don't know how difficult it would be to try to change your assessment to help managers manage for cost by the amount of volume that they ran through your shop.
Well, Madam Chair, members of the committee, that's a good question. The issue that we struggle with is the administrative cost of administering payments and the allocation and the overhead. We have meetings with our user groups and with agencies, and I think they're pretty much okay with our methodology because they can see the relationship between what they burden the state with in terms of their costs of their own operations and their impacts on DAS, they understand that relationship. You know, manufacturing facilities might use the numbers of phones lines you have as an allocation method. Mm-hmm. I've seen it, the number of light bulbs that are over your work areas in terms of an allocation methodology. There's all kinds of different ways to allocate overhead, and you just have to come to a reasonable conclusion as to the relationship between the methodology and your cost structure. Once you've accepted that, then it's just a matter of applying the mechanics of the formula.
Senator Morse.
Madam Chair, thank you. This is a question that I've had for quite some time, and maybe now is the time to ask it. You within your department have relatively fixed costs, but you have variable assessments that you make, so you will wind up with either over or under in terms of an account balance. And I'm wondering, how do you account for that, and how does it show up in statements?
Madam Chair and Senator Morris, members of the committee, the differences are going to be nominal, or they're going to be minimal, I should say. And those differences are taken into consideration in our ending balance, and as we move forward with the next budgetary cycle, we take those overages and underages into consideration. Mm-hmm. So really, over about two or three biennia, it smooths out. That makes sense? And we're talking large numbers here. So if you look at, for example, $2.79 on a payroll check, for example, that includes my staff, the cost of the mainframe, a reconciliation, filing tax reports, providing help desk services. All of that cost is in our W-2s, for example, at year end. All of that cost is in $2.79 a check. We're probably one of the lowest service providers in the nation. There's only one other state, I think, that beats us, and that's West Virginia on a unit basis. And if you let me pay twice a month, I think I can beat their cost. You follow me? So we pay 45,000 payments a month, most of which are on a monthly payment cycle. So when you take those 45,000 payments a month times 24 months, and if you have an extra 2,500 payments or an extra 10,000 payments or 10,000 less, it's not going to make much of a difference to us. It's not material, I guess I would say.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
That makes sense?
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Okay, the assessments here are, and I also wanted to let you know that the assessments and the fees there on that page 28 total $26.2 million. And that's really the assessments and the fees that were generated prior to our putting the budget together. And so in that assessment is a 3.5 package that we pulled after we put the assessments together. So really, that's $26.2 million will have to be reduced by $3.5 million. That makes sense? We pulled a package. Another view of that shown on page 29, it looks at it from the standpoint of limited and non-limited. On our limited expenditures, it shows 9.1. That's really operational costs of staff, space, phone, office supplies, that kind of thing. 90% of that $9.1 million would be personal services. The rest would be non-personal. The $13.5 million there, or the non-limited, is really the cost that we pay for technology to support the payroll system, the accounting system, the data mart, some printing and distribution costs, and treasury charges. So that's kind of the difference between limited and non-limited. Okay? Spending history... on page 30, the new payroll system was implemented in 1985. It cost approximately $16 million plus agency costs, 1985. A new statewide accounting system implemented in 1997, $21 million for a new accounting system statewide plus agency effort. I wanted to mention this because part of the charge here was to talk about potential spending. The payroll system implemented in 1985 is now 20 years old. It's a 20-year-old mainframe system. It was designed and architected in the early 1980s when Oregon was in almost a depression. And so the charge to the designers of the system were to make this system as inexpensively as possible. And that's what they did. They designed a very minimalist payroll system. It just does the basics. They took out every bell and whistle. They just did it the raw basic account, payroll system, basic accounting for payroll services to the state. So to replace that system today is likely in the neighborhood of $100 million. Now, $100 million for both the software, the systems integrator, and the agency costs. I think we've learned our lesson here. We want to make sure that the legislature and the policymakers and decision makers here understand the full cost of some of these system efforts. So this would be probably in the neighborhood of $100 million to replace the payroll system.
What are you telling us, Mr. Radford?
Well, it's 20 years old. We are currently operating on a master plan that we developed in 1991, so that's almost 15 years old. Our strategy has been to try to extend the useful life of these systems. For example, the DataMart. Try to extend the useful life of that system. Now, I'm not concerned about a 20-year-old mainframe system. The state north of us has, I think, about a 35-year-old system. Same with the state east of us has about a 35-year-old payroll system. So I think we've still got plenty of useful life out of the payroll system. But in a couple of bienniums, we'll probably want to start talking about a replacement strategy. That makes sense? And these are large system investments that we're talking about in today's dollars.
As far as all of the technology work that the Department of Administrative Services is doing, do you have some kind of a timeline or a projection out that begins to detail this? I mean, this panel right now is hearing that we have a $100 million problem looming in a couple of biennia. I keep reflecting on the conversations that I've had recently with Mr. Fleming, and thinking about the magnitude of investment that's coming. Is there a information technology or some kind of a source document that goes out maybe 10 years or some kind of a lookout in the future that contemplates all of this?
Madam Chair, that and members of the committee, that last time we did a strategic kind of a vision or view of technology and kind of looking out, kind of like doing an environmental assessment, where are we with respect to technology today? Where do we suspect that it's going in the near term, say maybe 5-10 years, and where do we think we want to be 15-20-25 years out? The last time we did that was 91. And, if it were up to me, over the next biennium or the next biennium after that, we should entertain a discussion about creating a new strategic plan, a strategic vision for technology, particularly around the enterprise systems, accounting, payroll, personnel, budget, purchasing, how are all these systems coming together and how are they working together and where are we relative to current technology? Where do we think we're going to be looking out 15, 20, 25 years?
Does Mr. Fleming's shop own that assignment?
I think DAS owns that assignment. I think all of the divisions of DAS have got to work together to produce that kind of a document, and with their customer base, with 108-plus agencies.
Would such an inquiry include looking at a different structure of doing business in the state? For example, the thing I spoke with you yesterday, the concept that I spoke with you yesterday about the shared back room for all of the agencies. Or my feeling is that we can't just keep doing business the way we're doing business with new systems. Would such a comprehensive look suggest to the policy body that maybe there's a better way to do the work?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I think so. It has to be structured and included in the consulting contract that you're going to bring in and help you go through those, that spade work that I call it. You have to include that part in the, you have to include that as part of a deliverable. Okay?
Madam Chair.
Representative Bucking.
Would you explain in more detail the 3-4 time increase in biennial operating costs that are listed under
sure.
the next two?
Yeah, under both of them. The next bullet down is implementing something that you've probably heard about, enterprise resource planning systems. Enterprise resource planning system is a fully integrated database and business application that has the same look and feel, same architecture, same design structures, same terminology across all of the enterprise applications, accounting, payroll, budgeting, personnel, all of that. And those systems in other states are typically costing $300 to $400 million plus to do. The cost estimate in Florida reached $650 million, and Jeb Bush pulled the plug on it. In Pennsylvania, they started out in the neighborhood of estimating anywhere between $100 to $150 million, and they're now over $400 million. So, you know, we can't go into this with our heads in the sand. We've got to understand what these cost structures are and how important cost estimation is on these projects. All of those states that are implementing ERP systems and the newer kinds of technology, particularly when you go from a payroll system that was minimalist to a payroll system in today's world, you're talking about 3 to 4 times the operating cost. My staff would probably have to double or triple in order to run the system. Same thing with on the technology side. These systems are much more complex. They do a heck of a lot more than what the old system did. Does that make sense?
No.
No,
no, it doesn't. Thank you very much.
Yeah, there are no savings. I guess that's what I'm trying to tell you. There is no cash flow ROI savings when you have such an old system that you're bumping up to a more robust system that does a lot more. It's extremely much more complex from a business side anyways, and we're seeing that the these other states are adding staff to handle the level of complexity and the services to the agencies that these system requires.
Madam Chair?
Follow up.
I'll try.
Thank you.
When you say there's this new element of service that these new systems provide, does that mean that we're not doing things now that we should be doing that this new system will bring to us? Or are we accommodating everything we need to accommodate now? And if that's the case, why go to the expense and effort of updating the system?
Yeah, I think that's a reasonable comment and a reasonable observation. There are some states that are working hard at trying to figure out ways to avoid an ERP implementation because of the investment cost up front and the back-end operating cost increases that are going to have to accompany that. They're doing exactly what you said, Representative Lincoln, is looking at extending the useful life of their legacy systems.
The OLCC has it right by using those little 3x5 index cards.
Yeah, with one person.
With one person.
I think the fact that the director has joined you would be an indication we should invite her comment. Director Warner?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Lori Warner, the acting director for Department of Administrative Services. I think what John's trying to show you here with these two bullets is things that are coming on the horizon. We haven't made any decisions as a state about how to move forward. We recognize we have aging systems. There are states that have tried the enterprise resource planning, the ERP systems. They're more robust. They're more complicated. They integrate functionality across payroll, human resources, and IT structures, which is a lot of people find that desirable. But that doesn't come without a cost and added complexity for all those things to be able to be integrated. The state of Oregon has taken an incremental approach to replacing systems, and you've seen that in terms of the recent efforts on the Orbis project. That's the budget system. SFMS was implemented, which is the accounting system first. So rather than do a complete system change out, which is what the ERP would be for all of those, we've invested incrementally in the various systems. Now, there's pros and cons to doing that, but each of these are coming up on time horizons, and we're going to be working on that in the interim and looking at what should the future look like and what possibilities are there. So today we have current operating systems. They're doing fine, but we're going to have to start looking to the future, and we're going to have these conversations about what should the next steps be for the state of Oregon, what should we invest in, and in what time frames. And I think John's trying to give you a sense of the magnitude of the dollars that you can see on these pages. They're not inexpensive, and that means additional probably COP financing and debt service for the state as an enterprise-wide system. So with that, I think John probably can move on the rest of his budget, because there's no answer here. There's no package in this budget to ask you to invest in either one of these things at this point. This is just context for the future.
I certainly think, though, that it leaves us, having heard the magnitude of the problem, interested in what's the path to get some master plan that would guide this level of investment or make the business case for it. Doubling the number of personnel required to run one of these systems, I join Representative Ivaki in some degree of incredulity as to why we'd want to do that. But I think what we're looking to you for is some indication that this is a problem you've identified, DAS owns it, DAS is going to begin to come forward with some guiding document that helps the legislature make decisions about
that's true.
Level of investment.
That's correct, Manager.
And one more.
Representative Ivaki.
When you say 3 to 4 times the increase in cost, are you talking about cost to DAS, or would there be savings realized in other agencies?
Yes, Madam Chair and Representative Ivaki and members of the committee, that is true. That the central cost is going to increase significantly because we're going to be using technology to do many of the things that are out in the agencies across the corporate landscape. And so we haven't really assessed how much savings are out there in the agencies that would help in part offset some of that operating cost increase. But for DAS's budget, we're probably looking at an order of magnitude of increases here when you start to bring in these more larger, robust systems. But there would be, in theory anyways, cost savings out in the agencies because you're going to automate a lot of those business processes. Does that make sense?
So far.
Okay. Well, we can move on to page 31 here. That's just a summary of 0305 as it compares to 0507. And this $22.5 million in 0507 does have that package removed from the cost structure, so you're down to $22.5. The biggest decrease in cost is debt service. When we implemented our SFMS, our Statewide Financial Management System Master Plan in 93, we issued COPs. They were 10-year notes, and we've made our final debt service payment. So that came off the budget in this biennium, or last biennium, I guess. Page 32 shows total funds, general funds, other funds, budget, primarily just other funds, for the differences between 0305 and 0507. On page 33, you'll see 48 FTE for 0305, 48 FTE for 0507, plus a half a FTE that's related to a package. That's the health licensing boards coming down from Portland. We're going to do their accounting and budgeting work if that goes forward. Currently, their budgeting and accounting work is provided by Department of Human Services. And so there's a thought that they could probably get that service from us. So there's a package in there for half the FTE.
Dallas, did you have a comment?
No.
Okay.
So then with that, maybe Corey, you want to take that next slide?
Sure. Again, the essential package is the same sorts of things you've seen in all the other agencies. If you want to talk about the specifics, we can. I'm here to answer questions. Otherwise, I would...
I think we'll just move on. Anybody can come to you if after they've reviewed these and want to...
Sure.
Technical assistance with them.
Okay. And then on page 35 is that package 350, which is just a half FTE being added to the client agency shared services accounting section in our operation to provide for those accounting and budgeting services for those couple of health licensing boards up in Portland.
Okay. Any questions for Mr. Radford?
And the last is we don't have any in my phase one
presentation. Oh, I'm sorry. I skipped the performance measures.
Well, there's nothing there, really. The performance measures that I went over in the phase
one. Good. I want to spend $600 million, and we got nothing in the performance measures. Let's move along.
Okay. Works for me.
Okay. Any questions for Mr. Radford? I would still very much like your thoughtful analysis on those combined back rooms to the degree that you can put some thought to that, and before this budget moves out, get us some kind of a document that would at least set the framework for the discussion.
We'll try to work on that for you.
Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you very much. All right. We would now invite up Mr. Freeze, who is standing in for Mr. Fleming today.
That's right.
Madam Chair, while Mike is preparing, he's prepared already, I just wanted to remind you again of the comments that I had made on day one, and actually for the record, Cora Parker from the Budget Management Division, Department of Administrative Services. Just wanted to remind you again for context before Mike starts his presentation that the governor's recommended budget was essentially a placeholder level for the Information Resource Management Division. The governor had asked the department along with the division to walk through an evaluation of its core business functions, including any one-time initiatives, any ongoing initiatives, the cost structure behind those, the revenue stream behind those, et cetera. So the department and the division have done that. They've done considerable work, and I just wanted to give you again that context before Mike starts into his presentation. He will go into some more detail about that during his presentation.
And I think Dallas has a comment.
I'd like to follow on. We've been working closely with them so that I would caution you not to get into the detail in this book at all, because it's been reworked, and we'll be approaching it talking about what they're actually presenting now as opposed to this document that was prepared almost a year ago.
Okay. And I would only add that in order to get this budget moved, we want to keep the pathway open to ask any questions. And while I hear Mr. Wynan suggesting to us we not get into too great a level of detail, I also don't want to pass over questions that members of the panel may have, and we just ask that you flag them. I know that Representative Krupp, who unfortunately isn't here, has some questions. He'll have to just get caught up with this at this point. But I don't want to stifle the opportunity to ask him. I just think we'll move through the presentation, and we can ask Dallas to catch any of the questions.
Very good. Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Mike Fries, Deputy State Chief Information Officer, and I am standing in today for Don Fleming, who's unfortunately out ill. I'm sure he would rather be here with you. Let me start by providing a little bit of context for this rebuild budget that we'll be talking about. The mission, you'll be thankful to know, has not changed from the time we did the Phase 1 presentation, so I won't spend a whole lot of time on that. But in terms of setting context, I'd like to talk about some of the changes organizationally that have occurred within IRMD, the Information Resources Management Division, in the last 2 years.
And I'll give you a pass to say IRMD through the whole presentation.
I appreciate that. The really one of the constant theme here that we're looking at is what we call adding an enterprise component to what's a default agency-centric business model. There are some things in the information technology arena that we can leverage to achieve economies of scale and do more efficiently, create opportunities for interoperability, and just provide better service, and we've focused on those.
Could you give us some examples for those of us that are not conversant in the language of your business?
Absolutely. One good example is the Computing and Networking Infrastructure Consolidation Project, also known as Scenic. The state runs multiple data centers and networks today. We know that by consolidating those, we can produce some economies of scale and drive the cost down to provide that service. Interestingly enough, we can also, in addition to saving money, we can produce a better quality service that's more reliable. So that's an example where investments can be leveraged to achieve economies of scale. There are some other opportunities in the realm of, for instance, electronic messaging, email. The state runs multiple email systems today. Over the course of the next year, we will do a detailed analysis of that. And we believe, in fact, we're pretty certain that we can do it for far less money than what we're spending in the aggregate today by consolidating to a single or a few email systems. So those are a couple of examples.
Thank you.
You're welcome. We acquired the Oregon Education Network and the Geospatial Geographic Information Systems in 1997. The Oregon Education Network, formerly known as EdNet, was designed to provide connectivity to rural Oregon for education and economic development purposes. And it's something that has evolved over time as the internet connectivity has become more pervasive. The geospatial information systems actually grew out of the Department of Energy. And this is something that multiple natural resource and increasingly public safety agencies are interested in. Geospatial information is the ability to lay a geographic layer over the top of other kinds of data, and it renders the data more meaningful for decision making.
Senator Morrison.
Question. We have this activity occurring in the Department of Revenue, in DAS, in the Department of Geology, Mineral Industries, presumably in ODOT. Is it necessary to have all four activities occurring, or is this something that you could do well in, you know, one function and then distribute the information?
Madam Chair, Senator Morris, that's a great question. The answer is yes and yes. There are some opportunities to do things more efficiently, and we're working with those agencies to take a look at that, and I'll describe that in just a minute. Geospatial systems are designed to be distributed, and that's one thing to keep in mind. And the reason they're designed to be distributed is because depending on who is maintaining a specific data set, that group or individual has authoritative responsibility for that data set. So, for example, Department of Revenue are the experts on what we call cadastral data or tax lot data, and they maintain those data sets, and they work also with local entities to do that. So they would be the authoritative source for that kind of data. Department of Forestry might be the authoritative source for information about fire prevention and that kind of stuff and fire threat data. So they each maintain that data set. The issue is how do we integrate those across the enterprise and how do we drive to common standards. There's a body called the Oregon Geographic Information Council, OGIC, which is comprised of those entities as well as federal entities and local entities. So this really can get to be kind of a cat herding exercise. But what that group does is it works on defining data standards. And then we're also working with that group on producing a business case to do an enterprise utility for GIS, because we do think there's an opportunity to do it more cost effectively by providing some kind of a central utility. We're going to work through that process. We'll produce the business case over the course of the next few months, and then we'll figure out going into the next biennium. We may be back before you, the biennium after this one, with some kind of a package.
This begs the question, Madam Chair, if there's something that should be done for the 05-07 biennium, if it could move in that at that speed.
It also begs the question, if you'll let me, Representative Smith, it also begs the question that I heard all the words that you said, but I didn't hear the piece that is the coordinating piece. We were over at the Department of Revenue on a little tour, and they're full steam ahead on what they're doing. I heard you say we're working on it, we're talking about it, we're thinking about it, but work is proceeding apace. And I think the question we're asking, or I'm asking, is where's the coordination now? Are we once again in the process of building these systems that are one-off systems and doing ostensibly the same kind of work? I think we understand that forestry has special and unique information about the stuff that they do. But how that information comes into a single place that is actually doing the technical work is the piece that I missed in your answer entirely.
Madam Chair, let me respond to that. I didn't cover that clearly in enough detail. We have the two bodies that do that. We have a statewide GIS coordinator, and that operates out of my organization, Information Resources Management Division. That person's responsibility is to do that coordination across the enterprise, not just within state government, but also with counties and federal.
So that person in your shop is looking over the Department of Revenue's person's shoulder to make sure that what they have is serviceable for different applications.
That's correct. There is also the Oregon Geographic Information Council, and that's the body. It's a governance body through which standards are promulgated. Now, it's important to understand there's an enlightened self-interest at work here, too. The Department of Revenue and every other department that's engaged in this wants to be able to adhere to standards because that makes their data more valuable to other people, and it makes other people's data more valuable to them. So we do have that coordinating function. There is an executive order through which the OGIC group was created, and that's the governance mechanism through which we get that done.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Chair Johnson. I'm out on a ledge on this, so I'm going to ask a couple elementary questions. I assume a data set is a block of information that's being stored electronically.
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, that's correct. A data set would be data about a specific topic or subject.
I assume there's a lot of information in a data set.
There could be quite a bit of information.
Are these stored where are these stored, these data sets stored?
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, they could be stored on systems locally. For example, if a county is maintaining county data, they would be stored on their local geospatial information system in a database.
Where does the state store it?
The state has systems or data that is stored in some central systems. The Department of Revenue has data in their systems, and other agencies that are maintaining that data has data in their systems.
You folks, just one last follow-up. Have you folks ever tried to coordinate with the facility in Burns, who apparently is a storage house for lottery data.
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, the Burns Archive Center has a couple of functions, one of which is it's what's called a warm site for the lottery organization. And what that means is they can bring up some of their systems very quickly there. It's also a data archiving center for data for Oregon State Government. We back up the data that's in the General Government Data Center, and some other agencies use that Burns Archive Center. It was not designed necessarily to be a live database, although it's certainly something we would look at from a disaster recovery and business continuity perspective down the road.
Just one last question. One more. My understanding is, and Burns isn't in my district, it's 150 miles away, but my understanding is that Burns facility is very underutilized. And I'm curious if there's ever been an analysis done to determine how to maximize the investment that this body made into that facility and is still paying for to this day.
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, that's, again, a great question. One of the problems that has plagued the Burns Archive Center is that it has aging software, or it had aging software, which was incapable of supporting most of the platforms that exist in the state today. We have just upgraded that software. In fact, we're in the process of testing it right now, and we'll be able to support the bulk of the platforms that the state has right today. So the business volume is beginning to increase out there. Now, this also plays into the CNIC project, the Computing and Networking Infrastructure Consolidation, in that today the state may have 12 different backup strategies and archiving strategies for 12 different agencies. We'll have one when we do a consolidated data center, and the Burns Archive Center will play a key role in that backup strategy. The third thing that we're doing is we're actually working with local officials in Harney County and others to look at options to make the pie bigger, if you will, to see if there's not a public-private partnership opportunity. We're exploring that pretty aggressively. So the Burns Archive Center, it has had those problems in the past. We're turning that around pretty quickly.
I hope so. That sounds like a neat opportunity.
What would a public-private partnership in this context look like?
Well, Madam Chair, it could be anything from what we would call co-location, where we occupy the same facility, to a partial or full outsourcing kind of an arrangement where we would buy a service from a private entity.
Okay.
Very good.
Please continue.
Thank you. We've, again, acquired the publishing and distribution operation in 2002. The reason is, if you took a look at what was happening to publishing and distribution, we're increasingly involved in electronic output as a means of output rather than ink on paper. So the two organizations were sort of colliding. It made sense to have them intersect rather than collide. The state enterprise network, SOEN, and we're in the process of we're going to re-solicit that contract so that we have an enterprise network contract. Began launching an e-government program in 2001, and that was primarily putting in place some infrastructure. Where we are today with that program is exploiting some of that infrastructure to produce some applications that are visible to the public that make accessing government easier.
Would you say that in a way that gives some examples?
Certainly. Let me give you an example we're working on right now, Madam Chair, and that is a central business registry. So if you're a business or you want to become a business in the state of Oregon, you may have to deal with as many as 12 different agencies. And instead, what we'd like to be able to do is make it so that you don't have to understand how state government is organized in order to do business with state government, and furthermore, that you can do it on your own time, at your convenience, from your work or home location. So what the central business registry would allow you to do is go in, describe what it is that you want to do, and it would guide you through the process of registering a business.
Okay, and how up and functional is that right now? I want to start a sewing machine repair company in Burns.
Madam Chair, we're working that project right now, and it's not, I believe it's in test right now, but I can get you the detailed information on that.
I know what you're going to ask, and go for it.
I smell a little blood here. Who are your partners on this project?
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, the Secretary of State's office, the Employment Department, Consumer and Business Services, if anybody who's involved in some way with business registration, licensing, or oversight.
Payroll?
State payroll.
How to meet the state regulations for payroll?
I don't know if that's within scope for this or not.
So what, follow up. What function does Information Resource Management Division play with these other partners? What's your role at the table?
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, we provide the technical solution that enables the, whatever the business strategy. So if what we're trying to do is make it easy for you to come in and register a business and you don't have to know how to navigate your way through state government, we provide the technology platform and the resources that would do the application development to support that.
So just one last. So I finally found the person who knows how to take the concept and make it happen.
That's what we're there for.
I think the piece that's missing for me is, do you have some kind of an advisory board that is suggesting to you what might be useful versus you deciding what might be useful? I keep thinking about the questions that Representative Smith has very thoughtfully asked that make it possible for Betsy Sewing Machine Repair in Burns to come into the state system, find out what the requirements are on my company, find out where I get payroll guidance, find out about workers' comp. I want to follow the rules, but I don't know how to access them, and I don't know where they are all reposited in one place. And ideally, that's what we want. And I guess what I'm looking for is some reassurance that there's some input into what would be useful for a startup company to be able to have in this e-government application.
Madam Chair, again, an excellent question.
I stole it from him, so it's
a good question.
It's our question.
Fortunately, I have an answer for the question, which will make sense. What you're really talking about is making sure that the technical solution is driven by a business strategy, by something that's meaningful to the people that need to use it.
Yes.
And so I think if you take a look at the history of the e-government platform, that's been one of the flaws that both Don Fleming and I recognized in terms of how it was implemented. It was primarily a technology strategy. And what we're really talking about is how we can streamline or change business processes so that they're more transparent to citizens and to businesses. So what we did was we came to the legislature and asked for some funding to put in place an application that would be a demonstration application. We then went to the business community in Oregon State Government through both, at that time there was an Information Technology Executive Council, which is comprised of the business leaders, agency heads, and the Chief Information Officer Council, which is the body that we work through to do enterprise planning and enterprise technology initiatives. They identified a couple of potential options, one of which was the central business registry, because they identified a common business problem that spanned multiple agencies and jurisdictions. We then come to the table with a technology solution that supports the business strategy.
Representative Smith.
Chair Johnson, how often does this group of folks meet?
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, the group of the CIO Council group meets, I believe, once a month. And the scenic governing board, which is a body I've not talked about yet, which sort of subsumes some of the roles of the Information Technology Executive Council, meets periodically as needed to make a...
Are those statutory committees or just good idea folks getting together?
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, they are not statutory committees, and that's an issue that we want to resolve at some point in the future. We can deal with that through the rulemaking.
One last question.
Follow
How would you guys feel if someone butted in and joined you in those meetings to make sure it was done with some legislative intent behind it?
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, there are certainly open meetings, so I'm sure I would be fine with it.
Let's take it one step further. How about you notice Representative Smith the next time one of them is going
to
meet?
That would be great.
I think what some of us are struggling with, because we see it in all sorts of different applications, is how do you say Oregon is open for business? How do we have a cogent mechanism to get outside businesses to know how to navigate around electronically? And how do we get help to our small and emerging businesses who are just maybe one person with a good idea who wants to figure out what all would be necessary for me to set up a business and be successful and not break the law? I've struggled with the brand Oregon. We're spending lots of money, albeit much donated, but we're spending lots of money in these fancy magazines to entice folks to want to come to Oregon and do business. And I'm part of this, and I've struggled with what's the portal. How do I come in the door in Oregon and know how to do business? And I think we're asking exactly the same thing with your e-government initiative. How do I know as a small business person in Burns that it exists? How easily can I get into it? How comprehensive is it in giving me guidance through what I see from the outside as a morass of hurdles that I have to jump over in order to get my little business up and going and in compliance with the law? And I think that we get a little lost in all of the nomenclature of your business, and I think what the committee's looking for is just show us it works. And that's really ultimately the goal.
I'm going to butt in and work with them.
Cool. All right. Well, send him notice.
Very good.
Okay.
Whether they like it or not, I'm coming.
Plow ahead.
I will be glad to do that. Enterprise Security Office, again, launched in 2003.
You're on page 10, just to bring everybody
buddy
along with you. Thanks.
And, of course, the Scenic Initiative, which I've already talked about, which started with a top-down business case analysis. We took an inventory of what we have out there in terms of assets, the staffing, and the costs associated with maintaining that, compared those to industry benchmarks, and from that derived the business case or savings opportunity. Where we are now in that project is in the process of building the budget from the ground up, so you'll see it get much more specific and detailed as we go forward.
Let's go back for a moment and talk about the Enterprise Security Office. When I think of the amount of data that's floating around in the system, whether it's over at DMV with all kinds of records or Department of Human Services, again, with much confidential information, how does the Enterprise Security Office interface with state agencies to give them guidance on security or to help them protect their systems, that you don't have somebody in there burning a whole file of the DMV records and outselling them someplace? Talk to us a little bit about how that works. And I understand some of this may be privileged information, but to the best of your ability, share with us why this panel ought to take away a feeling of confidence that you're moving in the right direction with respect to security.
Madam Chair, first of all, we've got our best people on it. The issue is that historically, Oregon state government, and we're not unique in this way, has not really taken an enterprise view of security. And security is one of those things that the risks have continued to increase exponentially over time, and our level of effort and investment has not kept pace with the risk. So that was one of the reasons for the establishment of the Enterprise Security Office. Now,
how many souls are there and who owns that?
In the Enterprise Security Office, mm-hmm. The Chief Information Security Officer is Teresa Massé, mm-hmm. and she has a very small staff at this point, but that's one of the policy option packages that we'll be talking with you about.
Okay.
What we're trying to do there's a couple of things we want to do. One is we want to make sure we put in place some solutions that will knock down some of the biggest risks and threats. And in order to get after that, we did a comprehensive threat and vulnerability assessment so we would have a factual foundation on which to put together a plan to go after those issues. Most state agencies have somebody in their information technology realm or in the business realm that's what you would call an information security officer. And Teresa Massé heads up to coordinate that across multiple state agencies and Information Security Council. Comprised of those people. They meet regularly. In fact, they meet very regularly now because we have a cybersecurity initiative going forward that's going to mitigate some of the risks we discovered through that vulnerability assessment. They're also doing enterprise planning and informing the Scenic Project, because the Scenic Project is one of the biggest vehicles we have to resolve some of the problems that we saw. Now, the specific example that you talked about is data. So how do we prevent the wrong person from getting access to data they shouldn't be able to get to? And today, our capacity to do that is actually quite limited. One of the initiatives that we're putting in place to go after that is what we call access control. And the concept here is that you have a central system that allows us to determine who you are, based on your role, what you have rights and access to, what you should be able to get to, and control that through a single point. Also to shut off access through a single point. And that's a very common strategy that's used by businesses both large and small, and certainly by enterprises like state governments.
Thank you. That was helpful.
Well, the Scenic Project, I think I've already described. Again, we're in the process now of building the budget from the ground up, and Scenic will be dealt with in a separate budget process for all the participating agencies. The other thing that we're focusing on, and this is really pretty important, is business continuity planning. Now, when we consolidate 12 agency data centers into a single data center, we ought to have a pretty robust disaster recovery plan in place, and we will. To inform that disaster recovery plan, though, we need to know what the business priorities are. And the last time that the state of Oregon really did a comprehensive business continuity plan was in 1999 in preparation for the year 2000 rollover. So some of these things are fairly aged. Some of them are reasonably current. Very few are very current and tested. What the business continuity plan exercise goes after is the enterprise component of business continuity planning. And let me give you an example of what I mean by that. If I have a priority one issue in terms of bringing my business process back up, but I have a dependency with another organization, and that my dependency with them is a priority 36, I may have a difficult time bringing my process back up. So recognizing that interdependency, it's important that we also have an enterprise component to BCP, and that's what we're working on right now. We've selected a common software tool to do that across the enterprise, and we've got the scenic agencies participating in that business continuity planning process along with Treasury, because Treasury is really an integral partner to virtually every state agency. And you'll see that it will be an iterative process, and it'll get more detailed as we move forward. Finally, one of the problems that has plagued IRMD over the years is a lack of sufficient management information and controls. And there are two aspects to that. One is just access to good and current management data, and the other was frankly a lack of continuity and consistency in management practices and controls. So while you can get a sense for the change that's occurred in the organization over the last 10 years as things were consolidated, merged, and we were asked to take on new initiatives and strategies, there wasn't nearly enough effort focused on strong management and management controls and management reporting. And I want to talk to you a little bit about what we've done to ameliorate that, to correct that. One of the things that Don and I have been engaged in over the course of the last year or so is bringing up a new management team, basically putting in place much stronger management capabilities, and we've literally replaced a lot of the management team. So we brought in some really excellent people to lead the line organizations. We're putting in place a division-wide metrics program, and that's an iterative process because we want to be able to make decisions based on facts instead of how we feel about how our business is doing or what we think is happening. We want a factual basis for making decisions and increasing the decision-making and budget support capacity. So getting to managers information that's timely and that's actionable, reports and information that allow them to actually manage their functions. We have worked with our operations division because we're not in the business of accounting and budgeting. That's not our reason for existence, but it's vitally important to support what we do in the information technology arena. So the operations division provides that service for us, and it's really kind of a shared service approach to doing that. That has helped us out tremendously, and it's been vital in doing this budget rebuild process. We restructured the budget for 2005-2007 to correct a number of problems, which I'll talk about in a little bit more detail later. And as Cora Parker indicated earlier, the governor's recommended budget really was just a placeholder while we went through this rebuild process. We had to correct some of the deficiencies that had been longstanding, that have been in place for some time. And we had also the impact of the enterprise initiatives that we needed to factor in, such as Scenic, which will radically transform two pieces of our business. Okay. On page 15. Again.
Let me just interrupt you for a second. Thank you very much for joining us. Bye-bye. Okay.
Again, the GRB was placeholder, and I want to talk about the rebuild budget as we go forward. Some of the reasons for rebuilding it I've already stated. We had some weaknesses in the program management, some outdated rate models. There were rate models that had been in place and, frankly, just inflated to deal with inflation factors over time without taking a look at whether they needed to be changed. And, in fact, in some cases, they definitely needed to be changed. Expenditures and revenue were not properly aligned with program business units. That creates some problems because you have some things for which you might be charging more than the actual cost is, other things which might be subsidized. And aside from the fact that that's not really a fair way to run things, it creates problems with federal funding and so on as well. And then the migration to the state data center that will occur through Scenic, and that affects two of our major line operations, actually three of them, but two of them directly. The general government data center is one of the 12 data centers which will be consolidated. Our data and video services operation, which provides wide area network services, will be consolidated. And yes.
I want to go back again and just touch on something. I'm listening to you talk and the level of expertise that you obviously have about this. I was thinking about Mr. Fleming. How deep is the bench? in terms of, as we begin to get these incredibly more sophisticated and expensive systems, what's the succession planning inside the agency to make sure that there's a deep enough group of folks that understand the complexities of these systems that we don't find ourselves in a personnel problem?
Madam Chair, I think that's an excellent question. That's one of the things Dr. Fleming and I have been focused on really strongly for the last year, is building some bench strength in the organization. I would tell you today that organization has the best leadership team I've ever seen there. In the down to the line management level, we have a very solid organization, and the folks that are in those line management roles are versatile and knowledgeable and credible, and they're good both in the management and leadership arena and the technology arena. You can play multiple roles. So I think Don would tell you the same thing. I'm very comfortable with the bench strength within the organization today compared to where it was just a couple of years ago.
Thank you. Senator Morris.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm not clear just what relationship CENIC has with the State Controller's Division. Does it have any relationship at all? Any of those functions incorporated into CENIC?
Madam Chair, Senator Morris, no, CENIC really doesn't. The one thing that there is a relationship with the State Controller's Division is that the General Government Data Center currently hosts the State Controller's Division's applications. In fact, State Controller's Division is the largest customer for the General Government Data Center. So their application set, the applications that we run, will move into the new consolidated data center.
Follow-up?
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you. There are some cost drivers that are somewhat unique to information resource management. I talked a little bit about the change in the business model, the addition of this enterprise component, which has been being driven by a couple of things, one being the need, cost pressure, the need to drive down cost. The other is the need to improve interoperability and some other things. The enterprise initiatives such as cybersecurity, e-government, those things which are new capabilities that we didn't have to worry about 5, 10, 15 years ago. Business needs keep evolving. There's certainly pressure on state government to be more transparent and to be able to conduct business online. Those kinds of things drive some of the technology changes. The technology itself changes out from under us. So, you know, for example, telephony traditionally has had its own kind of network infrastructure.
Stop. I have no idea what that word means.
I apologize, Madam Chair. Telephony, you pick up your telephone and you get a dial tone, so the ability to make a phone call.
You understand that. Got 54 years, and I never knew that I was engaging in telephony.
Well, Madam Chair, technologists are notorious for, you know, obfuscating the jargon, so call me on it every time I do that. And I have to the ability to pick up the phone and get a dial tone. There's a phenomenon known as voice over IP. Really, what that means is the ability to do to make telephone calls over the internet. That's and it's also a subset of a larger phenomenon we call convergence, where two different kinds of technologies come together. Okay, voice over IP is going to have a radical impact on the state's cost structure for providing telephone services, and it'll provide us some opportunities to do some other neat things, like be able to integrate voicemail with email, with a variety of other kinds of services. So that's an example of an evolving technology that you know, puts us in a place where we need to be able to reassess how we provide a service.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Chair Johnson. I'm not sure you're the person I should ask, but you're the person before us, I guess. I have a lot of small rural communities that have multiple state agencies in them. And in those state agencies, they each have their own video conferencing capability. I wonder, is anyone taking a look at creating just one conference room where they can come and check out or utilize the room when they need it and make it state of the art rather than having three or four video conferencing facilities in a community of 1,500 people?
Yes, Madam Chair, Representative Smith, that's a great question. We have a video and online services group that is doing that exact thing, and we work with some of the larger agencies in particular to choose a standard product set and to be able to provision that service. I think historically a lot of folks have done it themselves, but there are some obvious opportunities to make it both more efficient and a lot more effective service there.
But who in the state is keeping inventory and saying, small little community of 1,800, you already have three state agencies with video conferencing capability. Probably the legislature shouldn't be allowing funding to be created for a fourth one. Is there anyone doing that?
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, we don't have a detailed inventory of all those small things. What we're trying to focus on initially is the opportunities to consolidate the larger infrastructure, because that's where the bulk of the cost savings will come from. And those communities that have fewer resources, the smaller agencies and so on, can benefit from that investment.
I'm just thinking, just really quick, and it won't occur this session, but a thought to plan for the future. Rather than having three in one community, perhaps we could have one in the library or in a conference room, and then we could connect to other communities that have nothing. Wallowa County, I'd rather see them in three different communities than three in the largest community. Just a thought for the future.
Well, and also how that fits in with EdNet, for example. I remember when EdNet was the hot deal with video conferencing, the only problem I always had with it was the mouths moved differently than the words, and it made having a conversation virtually impossible. Is that now antiquated technology? Because EdNet was available in a lot of hospitals, and that was the site for a lot of it. Is that still viable?
Well, Madam Chair, yeah, the concept is still viable, and the technical strategy for delivering it is what's changing. So the mouths moving along with the voice coming out of there, that's getting a little bit better. It's still somewhat problematic, but those services are still provided, and that we still provide those services through the Video and Online Services Group.
I just keep thinking again about the security issues with the stuff that you're raising. Phone lines. Phones are ubiquitous. Phone lines that can do all sorts of things and can access all sorts of data, and how you begin to think about the security that you need in a building like this. In my little tiny office, I've got three phones, and one of them is ostensibly out in a hallway. How we begin to think about protecting data in an entirely different way, particularly in these highly public buildings. Do you envision a time when I won't worry about the fact that our legislative offices are ostensibly in hallways and anybody has access to them?
Madam Chair, actually, I don't envision a time when we wouldn't worry about that, because physical access to systems is always a risk, and that's something that has to be balanced with, the requirement for openness and so on. Some of the things that are coming down the pike, though, I talked with you a little bit about access control and the concept of being able to identify who you are, not just by a password. There are other things that could be used to identify who you are, a key card, for example, or a key fob that you plug in, some means of identifying physically who you are, which could provide some security for higher level access. So the access control initiative that we're moving forward with is going to provide the infrastructure on which we build some of those capabilities. The network that we're reengineering will also have, and I don't want to get into the technical detail, let me just say that there are ways with some of the modern technologies that are emerging today to logically segment different kinds of data and traffic based on what it is and who has access to it, so that you can protect it pretty rigorously.
I have not yet had the opportunity to look at Mr. Henderson's budget with respect to the legislature and with respect to this building. Are you working with him to try to identify some of the unique security problems in this building with respect to data?
Madam Chair, in fact, we are looking at the security in this building. I believe there's an assessment that's underway currently. We did a physical assessment earlier this year, and Teresa Massé, we could provide you some more detail on where that is, but Teresa Massé has been, in her office, has been working with legislative admin.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Okay, just to remind us all, I think you're about ready to move to page 17.
I am. So I mentioned the change in the business model, enterprise initiatives, evolving business needs. We've talked about evolving technology, and then customer demand, which fluctuates and can change over time. One example is the need for remote connectivity. We have a number of small field offices, and that's a big problem for them. They have systems that are sitting out in remote field offices that may not have been backed up, that may contain critical data, and it's impossible for them to really have a good backup strategy unless they can get network connectivity. Over time, those are things that have not been factored into budgets, so we're trying to work with them to keep the cost of that down to be able to provide the basic service. We move on to page 18. This shows basically the expenditure history here, and I want to talk about a couple of things here. One is that the column on the right, the 2005-2007 proposed, also includes the cybersecurity POP. So if you take the cybersecurity POP off, it's actually down to the budget level of the 2001-2003 budget. Cybersecurity POP is $21 some odd million, and we've got $8.8 million, and the initial cybersecurity investment is already factored into that base budget. So this just kind of shows you what's happened over time. It's some of the new initiatives and requirements in the realm of cybersecurity that are increasing the expenditure.
Representative Smith.
Thank you. A 101 question here. You're a fee-for-service type division, I assume. You're providing services throughout multiple state agencies, and they're paying a fee.
Representative Smith, that's true for what we would call our mature line operations. So the bulk of our work is fee-for-service. There is an assessment, a small assessment, in the publishing and distribution operation for interagency mail. And then when we start up something new, and I'll use e-government or cybersecurity as an example, the funding strategy is often an assessment to get it started until it's mature and stabilized. And then
assessment against the agency or division
correct.
That is undertaking the activity.
That's correct.
Okay.
It could be an assessment across state government. It could be within the agencies participating.
Thank you. I just wanted to understand that.
The other, on slide 19, if you take a look at the FTE, we've actually reduced the number of FTE, and the number that you have on the right is incorrect. It should be 264.71. It's just a typo, which includes the 9.21 for cybersecurity POP, so we're actually 255.5 in our base today. The reduction in FTE came about in a couple of areas. One is in the publishing and distribution arena, where we constantly evaluate our sourcing strategy, and we actually have in place with Department of Corrections interagency agreement. We procure what we call traditional ink on paper print through Department of Corrections, and we're operating with fewer staff today than we have had. The other area is systems development and consulting. And systems development and consulting for a number of years had a fixed employee base, and it's trying to deal with a variable workload and variable skill set requirements. So we may need people that can program in one kind of programming language for this project and something completely different for the next project that comes down the pike. So it makes more sense to resource that function with a smaller base, and then you deal with the unique skill set requirement and the peak workloads by either outsourcing or using temporary staff for that kind of thing. So those are the two things that contributed largely to the reduction in staff. Moving on to page 22, one thing that's really clear to us, and we want to make sure that this remains clear both to us and our business partners, is we're an enabling function. Now, the state's not in the IT business. To the degree we are in the IT business, it's to support the business functions of the state. And I'm trying to make that really clear when we talk about e-government and how we're repositioning the e-government initiative. We also have a responsibility to act in a governance role for agency-specific applications. So we have a responsibility for the enterprise applications that everybody uses, but we also have a responsibility for the major investments that the state makes in an application arena. And if you think about where the risk and the cost is, it's typically in applications, because applications are what we would call a strategic investment. For example, you know, Mr. Radford was up talking to you about the payroll system, which we built in the mid-'80s. That's a strategic investment. It's still with us today, and we need to be able to extend the life of it for some period of time while we evaluate a longer-term strategy. Public employees retirement system application, strategic investment, and we've gone through a lot of work with PERS to come up with a replacement strategy for an aging dying system that they have. The Medicaid Management Information System, every state in the country is in the process of replacing its MMIS system, and we have a governance role there, working with them proactively on those projects, but also verifying that the strategy is correct, that they're dealing with the risk issues, that they're on the right track. We also take the lead in developing applications to meet the common business needs, what we would call enterprise applications. One example of that would be the Linus system, which we put in place here last session. It's the Legislative Information Notification Update System. And it's used by multiple agencies, and we were able to reduce the number of those similar applications in different agencies by having everybody use a common web-based system.
Mike, if I can interrupt you for a minute. There are a number of us that serve on the committee that here's the state fair's budget. And, of course, we got some pretty large operating losses. And I'm intrigued by the statement that IRMD takes the lead in developing applications that meet the common business needs of agencies. And I'm wondering, that enterprise is very unique in that it's really a market-driven enterprise. It's not an agency, typical agency function. Would they be coming to you to develop appropriate cost accounting management tools that serve the market-driven nature of their business? Or would they, where in DAS do they go to meet their needs, which are really unmet at this point?
Can I play off of that really quick, Senator? Senator Morris has taken a lead in economic development, looking at the way the state fair does its cost accounting. And one of the things I think you're coming forward to us with is that it's inadequate at this point in time.
There is no cost accounting.
There is no cost accounting. And I think Senator Morris is going to be sharing with our committee that that needs to occur.
Senator Morris, Representative Smith, you're jumping ahead to the next slide, but you're anticipating really one of the things I wanted to talk about here, which is how we sort out what we would call an agency unique or agency specific requirement from something that's more general. So when we're talking about common business needs, we could be talking about, for example, general ledger. And, you know, the term general implies that it's fairly common and standard. And most agencies have a fairly common requirement that could be met through a central system there. That's what the state financial management application is all about. There may be cases where an agency has a completely different business model. State fair could be one. I don't know the answer to that specific question. Lottery might be another one that has a unique business requirement that a central system can't fulfill or can't fulfill all of. And in that case, what you would see is an agency-specific application. Now, depending on the size of that investment and the complexity of that application, IRMD has a governance role that we might play. We are also available for consultation, although we wouldn't build that application for them. We would facilitate them getting hooked up with the folks who would build it for them. Or buy a commercial off-the-shelf application. I think one of the things that Don Fleming may have talked to you about before is we really want to begin shifting the bias in the state toward considering commercial off-the-shelf or even open source off-the-shelf first before we go build something. Because what history has taught us is it's very difficult to sustain homegrown applications. The people who write the code disappear, enter the witness protection program, and leave. You know, there's often no documentation, and so it's like performing surgery on an alien when you go in to try to modify these things. It's a pretty risky proposition. So we want to get out of that business and really take a look at leveraging the investment that you get with commercial off-the-shelf and open-source solutions that are supported either by a consortium or by a viable business and used by multiple organizations. So one of the first things we would do, and this is what we're trying to do with the strategic planning, we have to start with a common business or with the whole panoply of business strategies, identify those things that are common, and we sort things really into two buckets. One of them is agency-specific requirements, and we really want to talk about whether those are requirements or desires or, you know, sort of the history of how we've done things, and then identify common requirements. And where we play is we focus on the enterprise solutions, the technical solutions that will support those common requirements. Some of the things that have come out of that are, again, in the realm of cybersecurity. We're all in the same suit there. E-government, we all have some needs that are very common there to be able to do e-commerce, to have a single portal through which folks can enter and access state government. The geospatial I've talked about, we're producing a business case to take a look at what the opportunity is there, and certainly the consolidation initiative underway with Scenic and the follow-on initiatives that Scenic enables. If we move on to page 24, IRMD is really organized into three buckets. I won't get into the detailed complexity of the organization, but we have operations, which I talked about before. These are primarily fee-for-service organizations. Including voice services, P&D, the publishing and distribution operation, systems development, and then we have three things that are in scope, what we call in scope for Scenic, in whole or in part. The data center, the data and video services section I talked about, and then what we call our technology support center, and that's really the place you call to get an answer to any question about information technology within IRMD. So it's our primary point of entry for customers, for trouble calls, for questions about service. That organization will also provide the first call kind of support for the consolidated data center environment. I talked a little bit about the governance and oversight requirement. We have an administration. We're responsible for promulgating statewide information technology policies in accordance with our statutory authority. And we do that through a collaborative governance structure, but we're ultimately on the hook for making sure those get implemented and for overseeing that.
Multiple agencies or agencies have multiple people who are designing and maintaining web pages. Have you folks ever looked at having a web page group to where these folks can come to you and make sure their web pages just get updated, and having a full group of employees who do that for the state?
Representative Smith, we actually wanted to take it a step beyond that because we don't want to have people designing web pages. That's the technology, the state-of-the-art technology today makes it so that you don't have to know how to design a web page. And, in fact, that's one of the key components of our e-government platform is what we call a content management solution. So, for example, the content management solution has multiple templates. And if you're a user, you're a content creator, you don't have to know anything about how to design a web page. You log in to the system and you put information into a form and you select what template you want applied to that, and it publishes the web page automatically. So
is that available today?
It is, yes.
Okay, follow-up question. I think, Cora, this is for you. How come we're still funding positions then in different agencies for web page design and maintenance?
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, without knowing the specifics of the individual agencies you're discussing, I would assume that the discussion there or the funding there is for the mostly for the maintenance aspect of that, that while design may be still in the technical description of what they're doing, that it's not designed in the way that Mike has discussed design today, that really is starting to be pulled away from the agencies. That it really is the content piece. I mean, someone still needs to be responsible right at the agency level for the content that is uploaded and maintained at any given point for agencies.
But could an agency work out an agreement with Information Resource Management Division to have them maintain the website?
Yeah, Representative Smith, actually that's not the business that we're in. We're providing a platform that allows that to happen. I want to point out that we've only migrated. In fact, we migrated, I think, a little less than 50% of the agency web content because there is a lot of work involved in taking it from the existing websites and moving that content into the content management system.
So once the website's developed, then you want the agency to maintain their website.
That's correct, because they're responsible for the content. And, in fact, that's the whole point of a content management solution is we're providing a platform where you don't need to have people that are designing web pages. You just need to have people who are content experts and know how to use the system to be able to publish them. Okay, so we talked about the governance and oversight, again, strategic IT investment oversight, coordination of the various governing bodies that we work through, and then enterprise programs or change initiatives. And these are you can think of this sort of as an incubator, too, for new services and programs that need to come up, like cybersecurity, the GIS utility. These are the initiatives that make a change to the existing operation. So we're going from 12 data centers to one. That's a pretty substantial change initiative. And eventually that state data center will go into an operational mode.
Yes, question.
It's a 101 question. If you're going from that many down to one, what happens if something happens to that one?
Representative Smith, that's a great question. And, in fact, one of the things that we evaluated, it was one of the key components of the business case decision, was whether we should build or whether we should create two data centers or one data center. And it's an issue of balancing risk mitigation and cost. The state of Oregon is really pretty small in terms of its computing infrastructure. So when we consolidate all 12 of these state agencies, we will not get to even 76% of a medium-sized data center by industry standards. What that tells you is we're never going to hit the point of diminishing returns you get through economies of scale. Now, after the Scenic project's done, we'll continue to work with other agencies to consolidate the rest of that infrastructure, and we will still get to about a medium-sized data center. So what we have to trade that off against is if we take that medium-sized data center and divide it in half, we now have greatly reduced our economies of scale. In addition to that, a data center, typically you reach a peak point at which you need to put more infrastructure in place, and the way that works generally, the rule of thumb, is when you're at 80% capacity. If we were going to have two data centers, one which would be the backup for the other one, we would only be able to operate at about 40% capacity in either one of those, further diminishing the economies of scale. So that, if I might finish, the way typically these issues are dealt with is through what's called a hot site contract with a contractor who provides that service. They're in that line of business, and that's what the state of Oregon has in place today, and that would be our strategy going forward.
Again, this isn't I don't even pretend to understand half of this. So where does the Burns facility fit into all that? And I guess, let me just throw this out. Where does the Burns facility fit in, and what happens if there's a fire and your one burns up? And I apologize for the simplistic question, but that's
Representative Smith, it's a very good question. What the Burns Archive Center is where we store our data remotely. So we have data that's stored locally, and that's the data that we're currently working with. And there may be some data that's several iterations of backups and so on that are stored locally. Then there's data that's stored in Burns. So let's take a worst case scenario: a meteorite comes out of the sky and lands on the new data center, and there's a smoking crater in the ground, and we have to go find someplace else to go. We go to the Burns Archive Center to get our data. We go to the remote hot site, which is provided by the external contractor, and they bring up systems that look exactly like the systems that we were running, and we put the data on those systems, and we bring the systems back up. Okay? Great. You're welcome. Okay, on to page 25, and this gives you an idea of the breakdown at a aggregate level, at the IRMD level, for the expenditures in each one of these program areas and the total base budget and total FTE. So let's start by walking through voice operations. And one of the key performance measures here is that 99% of calls go through during peak call time. So phone calls, as you might imagine, they have peak times and they tend to be spiky. We want to be able to service 99% of the traffic in a very worst-case scenario. There are some unique exceptions to that. One example is the employment call centers, which have a higher-level requirement, and we're working with them to make sure that gets met outside of our current system. Just key accomplishments: processed 86.5 million phone calls in 2004, 5,000 requests for new service or service changes to existing customers. So you can see there's a lot of activity in this area. And one of the things we're doing is redeploying unused equipment to try to offset the cost of people buying equipment. This would be what we call customer premise equipment in common nomenclature. It's the telephone sitting on your desktop, that kind of stuff, and also some switches and so on that would support that remotely.
Question?
I assume processed 5,000 requests, that means someone needed a new phone line?
Or a series of new phone lines or a new phone system.
Okay.
And I've already mentioned 99% of the calls have to go through during peak time. Also working with the Smart Buy program, actually a number of the Smart Buy initiatives will impact IRMD's internal cost structure, but we were able to reduce the cost by $1.7 million in the next biennium. And we've upgraded phone connections in many locations to deliver better service. I mentioned already a future opportunity is what I call voice over IP. At some point, voice will be repositioned more as an application that runs on a network than as a whole separate technology infrastructure. Sourcing strategy, how do we do it? We have a very small contingent of state employees who manage this program, and the bulk of the work is done through contracts with vendors. Moving on to page 32, publishing and distribution operation. Again, we provide a wide variety of print and mail services and publishing-related services, and we can do that far less expensively than we can in each agency. In fact, in the mid-90s, we consolidated multiple printing and mailing operations. We were the first state in the country to do that and save quite a bit of money, not just in avoiding duplication of effort, but in driving down postage costs, which is really important because you might spend 5 cents to create a document and then 37 cents to mail it. And if we can knock that cost down to about 25, it's a substantial saving for the state.
Mike, can you back up just a minute? Offhand, what's the criteria for issuing cell phones, and how many cell phones do we have in the state? And this comes from my own experience in the business world when cell phones came out, I mean, our cost just was unbelievable.
Senator Morton, I can't answer that question, but we'd be happy to get you an answer. We actually don't actively monitor, you know, who's accessing cell phones. We have contracts in place for that. It is an issue that we've talked about over time because there, you know, concerns have been expressed about that, but we'd be happy to get back to you with the answer to those questions.
And I'm not sure what we do with the information, Dallas, because it's so embedded, I'm sure, in every agency's budget.
That money is in each agency's budget.
But it's not isolated in any way that you could see it. But if it's anything like my own experience, it's gargantuan.
Can I follow up? Is there a way to set a policy of determining a permanent rate that the state is willing to pay? I mean, in terms of budgeting with the departments? 5 cents a minute, 10 cents a minute? I mean, I don't, whatever it works out to.
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, I believe that the state does have a policy, and I believe that we have, I think, more than one, but a couple of different contracts that we can buy those services off of. But, again, we'll get back to you both with that policy and that cost information.
I hope you're buying a whole lot cheaper than I am. But it might be revealing, and I don't know of anyone that's asked that question in the past.
Comes up from time to time.
It does come up from time to time. Okay. I've not heard it.
We'll be happy to get back to you.
Okay. Thank you.
On publishing and distribution, again, some of the key metrics, we want to be able to process 80% of the metered mail on the same day. And what we do is we meter mail, we put the postage on it, and again, we're able to do that at the maximum postal discount. We deliver interagency mail, the shuttle mail, within 24 hours of pickup. And that's kind of an interesting business. It's one of the assessment-driven pieces. And it's something that the state of Oregon has to do because of something called the Federal Private Express Statute, which prohibits competition with the U.S. Postal Service. Someday that may change, but every entity of any sufficient size and, you know, geographic distribution has something that looks like this, an interagency shuttle.
Is that, thank you, Chair Morris, is that a statewide shuttle system?
Representative Smith, that's correct. It doesn't get to every location in the state, but we run up and down the I-5 corridor and off to the sides a little bit.
How does the backhaul work on that? I understand stuff going out. Is there an equal amount that usually comes back?
Representative Smith, for the remote locations, that's correct. It's we're picking up packages. We also use that same delivery mechanism, by the way. One of the benefits we got by coordinating or consolidating what used to be state printing and state mail was we now had a service delivery, a distribution network to deliver print product as well. So it's used for that purpose.
Are those state employees doing this, or is this a contracted service?
It's a state employees, and that's, again, consistent with the Federal Private Express statute.
Oh, I'm sorry. It's too bad, because just really quick, Chair, in more of the rural parts of Oregon, one of the biggest issues to economic development is backhaul, trying to figure out how to move stuff inexpensively, and if stuff's heading that way but empty trucks are coming, it'd be a great opportunity for a partnership.
I want to make sure I understand the service. So let's say the workers' comp board in Salem wants to send a packet of stuff to the workers' comp board in Portland. There's a state shuttle service, so within 24 hours they just put it in one box and they get it there without going through the regular mail.
Representative Vakian, that's correct. That's exactly the way it works. And again, 99.9% of all print jobs completed on time. That's in accordance with the customer's negotiated delivery date. Occasionally we'll get a date that's physically impossible to meet, and typically that's then negotiated with the customer.
Just one last quick question. I'm cheap. Is there any prohibition against remote counties or remote cities from partnering with the state on this? If they have stuff that they know needs to go to the state of Oregon, tossing it in with an agency?
Representative Smith, we actually do some of that with some of the county offices. I can't tell you in detail, but I do know that we will often carry stuff back and forth.
So if I had to send something to you folks, I could head down to a state office and toss it in there?
As long as it was on one of our distribution routes. Yes. Hey. Again, by through consolidation, we eliminated some redundancy agency print and mail services. 95% of the mail is metered at less than full rate. So that's that's good. I mean, that's where the bulk of the cost is. Interagency mail. Why do we not just send everything through the Postal Service? Well, it would cost us 47 times as much if we did that. So we can do it for cents, you know, on the pound rather than 37 cents an ounce. And the parcel delivery costs less than a UPS, although for getting to places that we don't actually have a distribution network to, we use UPS and FedEx and various other carriers. We've always been cognizant in the publishing distribution arena, particularly in the print arena, that we need to strike a balance between what we do in-house and what we outsource. So that's constantly revisited, and anything that can be done less expensively is contracted out. That comprises about 40% of the dollar volume. Moving on to page 36, systems development and consulting. Again, provides programming, systems analysis, project management, database administration, and we support the state's enterprise application. So the applications that run in the state controller's division, we support those. We support our HR applications and the PEB applications. We have repositioned that organization to really focus at the enterprise level, and I talked about the staffing strategy and how we want to be able to staff for the baseline and then be able to deal with the peaks on a per case basis. We've got a very strong leader and manager. I talked about the organizational bench strength a little bit earlier. We've got a very solid manager in there who's leading the organization. We have reduced the overall staff size, as I mentioned before, and increased the training budget, because one of the problems that plagues you, particularly in the systems development arena, is keeping current on your skill set. And it's an investment that you constantly have to make, and we had inadequate training budgeted for those staff. So what would happen over time is the skill set would age, and they wouldn't be able to work with the new technologies. Also looking at one of the key areas I mentioned before, that application development, you're making strategic investments when you build an application. So we want to have good, rigorous control procedures around that, and we've done a lot of work in implementing that, and we'll continue that. Our billing rate is substantially less than what we can buy on contract today at $86.50. And that doesn't mean we can service every requirement, because, again, we can only support so many skill sets and a certain amount of workload. But at least it gives us an edge for those things where we really have a core competency. And, again, development's outsourced, if the vendors can provide a less expensive solution or where we have a unique skill set or requirement.
Can you explain that again, that key metrics, average billing rate of $86.50? I'm sorry.
Yeah, we have an hourly billing rate. Typically, application development services are done in either a couple of ways. What you call a time and materials kind of contract, where we have a per hourly rate for a project which has not been completely defined. The other way to do it is on a fixed price deliverable, where we have some pretty detailed knowledge about the scope of the project, and we estimate what the cost is, and that's what you pay. Absent any customer-driven changes to it.
Is there a requirement that folks come to you first to get an estimate before they go outside?
Representative Smith, no, that is not the case. A number of folks do, but some agencies source their own application development shops, and there are good reasons for doing that, because that tends to be really closely aligned with the business function in the organization. So where you have agency-unique requirements that are being met through application development, we actually think that makes more sense once you achieve a certain economy of scale to be done at the agency level, so that you have that tight integration with the business. Where we have enterprise requirements, those are things that we would focus on. Okay, moving on to the page 39, General Government Data Center. This is an organization that's 100% included within the scope of the Scenic project. It will be consolidated. Today, we provide hosting services, so we run the boxes that all these applications reside on. I mentioned before that DAS is one of our biggest customers. PERS is another large customer, and then we have a variety of other customers as well. Very secure, highly stable environment. We have not achieved economies of scale there that would allow us to drive costs down to where they need to be, and that's one of the compelling reasons for doing the Scenic project. It's what we call a high availability environment. So this means it's up at least 99.9% of the time, and when we get into the consolidated data center, you'll see the same kind of high availability or even greater availability. We meet the industry standard for no loss of critical data because we have a multi-tiered backup and archiving strategy involving the Burns Archiving Center. And on the mainframe systems, 95% of the response time is less than a second, which is good. You want to be able to support those applications at that level. We store substantial amount of data in Salem, 65 terabytes in the Burns Archive Center, and that will probably that'll shift over time as we change the technical solution that'll enable folks to store data out there, and the rate model associated with Burns is changing to incent the right kinds of behavior, where in the past it hasn't always been aligned, and I think I talked about that a little bit earlier. 600 different production jobs run daily, and 200 mission-critical servers and the mainframe operation, the state's central mainframe for DAS.
And I appreciate these questions. I'm just learning a tremendous amount today. On the in the Burns facility, you mentioned earlier that there's a possibility for a public-private partnership. And I heard the conversation, but I don't recall hearing the timeline and when you see the outcome of a decision being made.
Representative Smith, we're working actively with some groups, as I mentioned, in Harney County, and we would like to be able to come to some conclusion about how we want to proceed by the end of this session, so around the June-July time frame. There may be, as part of that deal, some statutory changes that would be required. Obviously, we wouldn't make the deadline for that. That might need to be queued up in the next session. But if, very briefly, without getting too far off track, the history of the Burns Archive Center is that the state of Oregon, both lottery and Department of Administrative Services, are sort of physically anchored to Burns, okay, and that drove some economic development. We have 2.5 FT out there. Lottery doesn't have any. They just have some infrastructure investment. What we'd like to be able to do conceptually, and we don't know if this is possible, we're still working through this, is come up with a deal that's actually better than that, where the state of Oregon becomes an anchor tenant for some period of time to help build something a little bit bigger out there that's actually run by a private entity. We would no longer be physically anchored to that location, but as long as it met the service requirements and cost requirements of the state of Oregon, we would have no reason to move elsewhere. So those are some of the concepts that we're working with, and frankly, that effort has gotten a lot farther than I would have expected it to when we first started talking about it about 6 months.
That entity would own the facility.
That's one contract. That's one possibility.
And potentially contract back with the state.
Yes, that's one possibility.
Okay.
We're still working through the various options, and it's fairly complex because of the funding strategies that were used to build the Archive Center in the first place and a variety of other.
Legislation is required. Who's taking the lead in the building on that? Can you share?
We haven't gotten to legislative requirements yet. You're welcome. Okay, the data center, again, is staffed by state employees. What we tend to use contractors for is when we're bringing up new systems, so to deal with peaks or bringing in new skill sets, where we would do a train-the-trainers kind of approach or a knowledge transfer. Moving on to page 42, data and video services. Again, 100% in scope for the Scenic initiative. And we provide network and conferencing services, which we talked about a little bit earlier. We provide internet access for all state employees today, and we do that through a couple of what we call points of presence on the internet, so we have some redundant internet connectivity. Network connections to every city in Oregon, and the network availability has to be 100% up. Now, we have had some interruptions occasionally, but that tends to be a very highly reliable thing. We also run a central email gateway, so the email that comes out of state agencies goes out through this gateway, and it can come in through this gateway. And that actually positions us rather nicely to go after email consolidation as a follow-on initiative at some point, probably a year down the road.
Thank you. What's a network connection?
Representative Smith, a network connection would be what we would call a remote point of presence. So we would have a switch or a router connected to a building somewhere in a city. It could be a county building. It could be a state building that you could get access to the state's network from.
100% availability, you're looking at Troy, Oregon. You're looking at Granite.
Yes, the 100% of availability actually pertains to what we call the core network. That's a great question. In remote, there's a couple of problems. One is that when you get into remote geographic regions, there's often a single physical infrastructure, so there's one pipe
right. That
goes out there, and an errant backhoe can take that down, and you're down for however long it takes to restore that connectivity. We can't solve that problem overnight, but in our core network, which services the metro area, the Salem metro area, Portland and Eugene, has redundancy built in. We're working on getting redundancy established in the Burns Archive Center, because that's going to become fairly critical, particularly if we ever use that as a warm site. We'll need to have redundancy there, and that's one of the objectives of that public-private partnership. We'll probably never solve the problem of redundancy to every remote point, but other technologies like wireless and satellite and so on may help in that area.
Is it even cost-effective to do it?
We don't know. Actually, with some of the newer technologies, it may very well be, but that's something that will have to be explored on a case-by-case basis. And it's driven by business need. I mean, for some people, it's okay if a backhoe digs up the pipe and I'm down for 2 days. That really doesn't disrupt the business process too badly for, let's say, a remote fish and wildlife office. What they need to be able to do is back up their data in a reasonable amount of time so that they can mitigate that risk. And that they can't actually do very well today.
I want to advocate for the most rural parts of Oregon, but I also want to take into consideration the cost that
is
associated with that. Thank you.
You're welcome. And again, about 5,300 citizens participate in audio administrative hearings each month. That, by the way, has been a program that's taken off and has been remarkably successful. We can actually conduct those electronically over the network and record the sessions, and those are available then to those administrative judges. Video conferencing, allowing users in different cities to have real-time video meetings. We talked about that a little bit earlier. And we provide access to legislative hearings. In fact, people may be watching this very one through some of our services. We're doing some network improvements that will reduce the cost of the state in state agencies by almost $500,000 in the next biennium. And the Scenic project will also have an additional impact on that as we redesign the network and eliminate some redundant circuits that go out to some of the remote locations. That will happen over time. Can't all be done at once, but there are some opportunities there. We use open source software for what's known as spam. Those are those unwanted email messages that you get. In antivirus protection, and we have saved substantial money over commercial solution. We may at some point need to upgrade to a commercial solution, but we probably wouldn't do that until we get to looking at email consolidation. Again, the central recording of audio conferences, improving efficiency of transcriptions, and we internally staff this, and we buy circuits from telecommunications providers through an enterprise network contract. Technology Support Center, moving on to page 46. This is, again, the single point of contact. It's the front door you walk in, and you can get access to any of our services and or resolve any technical issue that you might have. A piece of this is in scope for the Scenic project. It'll be the front door for the state data center. This is a fairly new operation, and we put a manager in there to bring this thing up, and she's really done a remarkable job with this in a very short period of time, a little over a year. What our objective is to be able to resolve as many technical problems right there with the first phone call as possible. And the target we set is 80%, which is pretty aggressive. They've been able to get to 62% just within 1 year of operation. That's pretty remarkable compared to what other help desks are doing. Abandoned call rate, we want to keep that under 4%. That means somebody gets frustrated and just hangs up the phone and maybe smacks the keyboard or whatever they need to do. So we have 3% there, a call wait time of 8 seconds rather than 30, and system availability, where we want to be able to be at 99.9. We're achieving that. We have a good desktop support to IT support staff ratio, and the cost per node for support, including the software, $100. And a node is a computer sitting on a desktop. We're currently supporting desktop systems for DAS and for the governor's office, so about 1,000 desktops. We serve some external DAS customers. These could be e-government customers, data center customers, a variety of different customers. And when we talk about tickets, what we're talking about is when you call and an incident occurs or you report a problem, we create a ticket, and this allows us to manage that problem through to resolution. That's really a vast improvement over the way that this organization used to operate, where you had to know who to call to get an answer to a specific question, and depending on who you called, you might get a different answer. So we're able to manage these problems much more effectively today. And again, managing an asset management program within DAS. So how many desktops are we buying? What's their life cycle? You know, what's our plan to replace those over time? We want to be able to do that very effectively, and other state agencies are engaged in that same activity as well. We use personal services contracts as necessary. We also have a core staff that we use for the technology support, And we use state purchasing contracts and the contracts that SmartBuy has put in place to drive the to get the best cost for desktops and other systems. Moving on to page 52, governance and oversight. I mentioned our role there, and it really has to do with the strategic software development initiatives. Now, we're redefining that enterprise governance model for a couple of reasons. One is that it's really impossible for a central single entity to be versatile enough and knowledgeable enough and staffed enough to be able to deal with the enterprise governance requirement, because it tends to be somewhat spiky, and it comes along when you have major initiatives. Even if we could staff it up, no one would be willing to pay for it, because we'd have to have a small army available to go out and deal with these things. So what we want to be able to do working with state agencies is to have a more flexible model that recognizes that change in skill sets and would also recognize the change in workload, the peaks in workload. And so we'll be pulling resources working with agencies from other agencies to help with this process, and also contracting with third-party quality assurance vendors and so on to make sure that we can do this governance process effectively. We're just launching this. We haven't got it too far along yet. We recognize it's a critical function, and particularly when we work with the Joint Legislative Committee for Information Management and Technology during the interim, that's one of the things that we talk with that group about, is what are the major IT initiatives in the state in the realm of software development, and where are they? Are they on track? Are they still good investments? We still have a lack of enterprise-level management information. One of the things we're working on there is an enterprise chart of accounts for information technology, which would enable us ultimately to answer the most simple questions we ought to be able to answer, like how much does the state spend for computers? I mean, how much do we spend in software development? Those are questions that it's very difficult, if not impossible, to answer today, and we need to be able to answer those. And again, in putting in place an augmentation to the default agency-centric business model, so changing the culture to one that values enterprise action, things that we can leverage collectively to drive economies of scale and produce better results rather than independent agency action. The Office of CIO and Division Administrator, we oversee and coordinate the entire organization. The Oversight and Enterprise Planning and Policy, let me talk about that for a minute. That group supports the enterprise governance bodies, which we mentioned earlier are not statutory creatures today, but we want to be able to give those bodies some authority. IRMD has the authority to promulgate enterprise policy and standards, and those are the bodies through which we want to work those issues. Moving on to page 56, quality assurance. Talked a little bit about quality assurance. We have a requirement for projects greater than $1 million to have a quality assurance third-party QA in place. And we also, I talked a little bit about that virtual staffing model for going after QA and governance. We want to be able to resource from across the enterprise, pick the skill sets we need to be able to perform that function.
Sure, question. Mind if I ask? Page 55 provides governance, policy, and strategic planning support to the enterprise. But then I go back to our earlier conversation about these small communities who all have their own video conferencing facilities. And to me, it seems like somehow you folks ought to be charged with helping multiple state agencies in a small little community work closer together. What am I missing on this?
Representative Smith, I don't think you're missing anything there. I would tell you that we have just gone through a process of trying to refresh the Enterprise Strategic Technology Plan, and what we found interesting about that is that the first thing you would do typically with an Enterprise IT plan is look for the Enterprise Business Plan, which you would then attach the IT plan to as a supporting mechanism. There isn't any such thing, really, in Oregon state government. So what we did is we worked with the 12 agencies participating in CENIC, who represent the bulk of the infrastructure investment, and went through a process of defining what their objectives were and then what the IT components might be to that. What are the enabling IT strategies that will help them achieve the objectives that they need to achieve? And so some of the things we identified are that folks are going to be using video conferencing and distance learning technologies, for instance, to be able to push information out and to train their field staff. So those kinds of things would drive the enterprise IT strategy.
Isn't there a tremendous savings to be had, though, by doing it right in one location rather than having multiple little connections in a small community?
Representative Smith, I think there is some savings, absolutely some savings to be had there. And again, we worked initially with the 12 scenic agencies, so we want to be able to bite off, you know, digestible chunks and move forward and extend that out as we're successful.
So, let me just follow up just really quick on this. In our afternoon committee, one of the agencies that's before four of us, all four of us here, is looking at trying to do a statewide connectivity where they can do e-government. And I'm trying to figure out why we'd even advance that without first talking with you folks about tying it in with what's already going on out there.
Representative Smith, I'm not familiar with that particular initiative. Can't really speak to it.
I'm struggling with this.
Yes.
I guess I need to speak with you.
We could talk after the hearing, certainly.
To me, it seems like this is something in the interim where we ought to be looking at trying to figure out better coordination to make sure we're not building a whole bunch of systems where one would work.
I apologize for having to step out. I just realized I stood up one of my county commissioners this morning. Not a good thing to do. I don't know to what degree you haven't, is the answer, finished your presentation. I think given that we only have 5 minutes left, I'm going to ask that you return tomorrow morning and we finish the remainder of the presentation. We are at this point grievously behind schedule. And I just wanted to share with the committee the direction that I am going to try to take with some guidance from the co-chairs, and that is to move those portions of this budget, or to at least begin to move those portions of the budget where there are not a lot of questions and we think that there is generalized agreement. There are those other portions of this budget that are a bit more complex, the whole technology area, and I think that we will try to go there last, isolating the questions and sort of working through the issues. We are scheduled to have work sessions on Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday. We're still struggling through information management, and we'll be finishing that on what now appears to be Wednesday, indicating grievous behind. So I'm going to have a consultation with the co-chairs and try to figure out what portions we think we can move through without a lot of controversy. Dallas has been, I think, very good in capturing those areas where we have questions, and unless there is objection from the committee, we'll try to refine this schedule and get it to you and see what portions we can go ahead with. Any guidance, Dallas, that I stray from the facts here? Or?
No, Madam Chair, we were hopefully going to get through what we could with this agency. Next week we have the Department of Revenue tentatively scheduled for 3 days. And so we didn't have a lot of wiggle room in our schedule up through May 2nd, well, actually through May 15th. So we may have to squeeze in the bits and pieces later on that we can't get through the end of this week.
Because we have 3 days of the Department of Revenue and then the Board of Tax Practitioners, and that encompasses all of next week. And so I think what we'll try to do is to see how far we can get tomorrow with respect to finishing your presentation, and then depending on what guidance I get from the co-chairs to begin to isolate some of the smaller pieces. I'm thinking Office of Health Policy Research and some of these smaller bits that we can be able to move without having a whole lot of questions. So if that's generally agreeable to the committee, I think we will, given the lateness of the hour, carry over the public hearing on the Department of Administrative Services and Senate Bill 5501. Without objection, then we'll close the hearing and we are adjourned.